The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the century of lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Sanho Tree is the director of the Drug Policy Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. He gave a presentation recently on COVID, modernity, lifeways, and drug use as part of an IPS webinar series entitled Progressive Politics in the Time of Pandemic. We're going to hear portions of that on today's show.
There's nothing quite like having your life and your world come to a crashing halt for several months to really ponder the meanings of lifeways and modernity and how we got to be here and what is normal. And so I want to talk about drugs from that perspective. And I'm going to do so by talking about a number of different stories, vignettes, that will, at the very end, I will tie together. And if I fail to do so, please remind me. But one of the reasons drug policy has been so baffling and so difficult to reform and to fix is that we don't really situate the problem properly historically, but also it is one of the most interdisciplinary problems I've ever studied. And I used to be a World War II historian, right? And World War II was pretty interdisciplinary. It was very, very complicated. But there was a lot of clarity in terms of who the good guys and bad guys, quote unquote, were. When you talk about drugs, however, you're talking about an incredible supply chain that affects millions of people around the world, from peasant farmers to mules to traffickers to dealers to money launderers to all these different people. And so you have to know a little bit about each of these things to get the big picture. And the big picture is hard to explain to policymakers because our drug war establishment, both in terms of the bureaucracies involved, but also the congressional committees that do oversight and appropriations for these things, as well as the universities that train these bureaucrats and other academics, are very much, as well as the journalists who cover this. They're also beat journalists, or they specialize in certain aspects of this. But there are so many different silos that it's difficult to get a top-down overview. And when you begin to do that, the whole thing starts to look quite insane, right? And so what I want to do is try to break down some of those silos and talk about how we got here. And as a historian, I'm going to talk about the past first before I talk about the present. Whose job is it to make sense of all these different things? It's not the drug czar's job, because we put that office in the White House and we politicized the National Office of Drug Policy Control. It's situated in the White House, so it's become a partisan issue as well. But let me start by telling you a story about how we got here in this hemisphere. Let's start with the basics. About 15 years ago or so, I was asked to give a talk at Boulder High School. And it's a kind of an alternative high school in a sense that the students looked at your bio and they looked at the different things you've done, and then they come up with a title for your talk and you have to speak to it. And so these high school students, being teenagers, came up with a rather unique title for me to speak to. And it was about sex, drugs, and international relations. And I thought, oh, Lord, how am I going to tie all these things together? And it, of course, dawned on me at the last minute how to bring it together. And if you ask the question, well, how did we end up here in this hemisphere, the Western Hemisphere, most of us who are non-Indigenous? And it actually has to do with, comes back to drugs. When Columbus went, sailing across the ocean, what was his purpose? What was his objective? Why did he do that, undertaking this very risky voyage? It wasn't just gold and the search for lands and Christian crusaders. Primarily, it was for spices, right? And so why spices? Why were spices so valuable back then? It wasn't just because the food in Europe was bland and boring, which it was pretty much at the time. Each of these new spices, whether it's cinnamon or clove or nutmeg or any of these things, whatever it's new and exotic, it came from somewhere else. And this is how we think about drugs in our society, right? Drugs are what other cultures do. They're foreign, they're alien. And we imbue these substances with all kinds of alien properties we imagine they're associated with. And back in the day, when Columbus went looking for these spices, these drugs, these new drugs, had a word of mouth reputation. They were thought of as drugs because all these exotic new spices were thought to, you know, how do I put this delicately, put lead in your pencil, right? It was the Viagra of the day. And of course, aphrodisiacs are mostly working the head anyway. And so people were willing to pay a lot of money for these things. And so I guess you could make the argument that half the world got colonized because a bunch of old white men in Europe couldn't get it up. And thus, kids, you have the linkage of sex, drugs, and international relations. I'm being facetious here, but you get my point. That these things have deep roots. And if you take a look at the past 500 years of colonization and development in this Western Hemisphere, it becomes apparent just how profound the role of drugs and what are thought to be perceived as drugs at the time, what the role they played in the development of this hemisphere. In fact, for a good 400 years of that first period, they drove the development in many ways of this hemisphere. When we're talking about crops like sugar, where we get rum from, sugar was an incredibly valuable commodity. And sugar is a drug. If you don't believe me, try giving it up for 2 weeks. And at the time of the American Revolution, the island of Barbados was worth more to the British Empire than the 13 colonies in North America, simply because of the profitability of sugar and, of course, rum that came along with it. But also things like coffee, tea, tobacco, and spices. Just take tobacco, right? What would the United States look like today? What would Virginia or North Carolina or Kentucky look like today if we never had tobacco? That was the backbone of much of the economy in the early years of these colonies. Sugar, is a horrendous commodity if you look at what it took to produce that sugar. And by that, I mean it took enslavement, so that Europeans went to an entirely different continent to kidnap and enslave Africans to come and work on plantations in the New World to generate these profits that made these European empires very, very wealthy and created some of the banking fortunes that played a role later on in history. But the conditions in sugar plantations in the Caribbean were just off the charts horrific compared to, there's no point in comparing pain and suffering, but it was an order of magnitude different. And so throughout this history, drugs or things that were perceived to be drugs played a big role in how we got here and how we live our lives today and who has power, who has land and access to capital. Much of this is passed on generationally. So if you're talking about Black Lives Matter today, a lot of that is generational wealth that was never passed along because it was stolen from people of color, particularly African Americans. And all this comes back later on in the drug policy. We'll get to that. So I just want to give you a sense of some of the time scales we're talking about here. We'll talk a little bit about my own background. I'm a Chinese American. I was born in Taiwan and came to this country at the age of 4. But my father and my mother were from mainland China, and they left and moved to Taiwan, fled to Taiwan in 1949 during the revolution. But a few years ago, about a dozen years or so, my father went back to our ancestral village in China, and he brought back a digital copy of our family scrolls, the family tree, so to speak, no pun intended. And I knew it went back a few generations. I had no idea. I was not prepared for how far it went back. And we believe, it's hard to read some of the old script and they use a different calendar system, but we believe it goes back at least 26 generations, approximately to the year 637, give or take. And when I think about all of those generations that came before me, and the lives that they led. And I don't want to romanticize it because to be and they were peasant farmers in rural China, right? And to be a peasant farmer in rural China was not easy. especially if you're a woman in rural China as a peasant. But their life ways were very predictable and sustainable over many generations. Each, you know, and when I think about the last generation, my generation, I live a life that is completely alien to all of those, all of my ancestors that came before me. The energy resources I consume probably exceed all the energy resources my ancestors have ever used, simply because I live a modern lifestyle. I traveled a lot. The food that I eat comes from halfway around the world very often. We have a very globalized world that my ancestors could never have envisioned, much less learned to navigate. And navigating this new reality is very, very, very important. But in China, it's not unusual to have these long family trees because it's Confucian society. And not to romanticize Confucius either, but it was a Confucius laid down a formula for a super stable society, too stable in many ways. And that's why China suffered for so long. But it was predictable and sustainable. And we've since gotten rid of that, particularly during the Cultural Revolution in China. And we haven't really replaced it with new values and new ways of living and being and understanding our roles in this world, right? And this is a theme I'll come back to over and over again. And so that's kind of my family background. But let's take a look at more recent history. Let's look at some commodities, for instance. Corn, a simple commodity. What's corn got to do with drugs other than corn alcohol? Well, back in the mid-90s, there was a big debate over NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement. It was ultimately passed. A lot of us warned a lot of the downfalls, pitfalls of that agreement. But it was passed. And the technocrats, however, who engineered this free trade agreement in Mexico City and Ottawa and Washington, D.C., very often they basically, their shoes never got dirty, right? They live and work in marble buildings. And these technocrats just thought, well, let's talk about efficiency. We fetishized the efficiency. And Americans said, look, we can produce corn on an industrial scale in the Midwest through mechanized industrial agriculture, big agribusiness. And we can ship that corn to Mexico, thereby freeing up your farmers and your labor pool in Mexico can then develop with industrialization, et cetera, et cetera. These technocrats, however, I don't think really understood what they were tampering with, the life ways they were tampering with. So if you look at just one commodity of corn and how that played a role in anchoring rural Mexican agrarian life for so many generations, including pre-Columbian times, right? Corn was so central to people's life ways. It was a gift from the gods. It was your songs, your rituals, your holidays, your festivals, your feasts, all revolved around the planting cycle. And that kind of, you know, kept the community together. It gave them purpose and understanding of their role in the world and how to navigate that. And suddenly, we flood that society with cheap North American corn from the United States. And suddenly, these people are torn asunder from the land and the crop that kept them rooted and stable for so many generations. And they were thrust into and I'm oversimplifying this argument for the sake of argument, just as an illustration. This is not a direct line, and I'm not saying everyone went through this experience. But many of those people were suddenly torn asunder from the land that had given them, you know, stability for so long, and thrust into a brand new reality of concrete, steel, petroleum, silicon, into an urban life way, very often in the maquiladoras, the sweatshops, the factories along the border areas, and other sources of employment. But suddenly you have rural people migrating to urban areas. And the technocrats never asked themselves, who's going to teach them how to raise children in this new environment? Who's going to teach the next generation what kind of values, songs, traditions, that would root the next generation? Our life ways are evolving so quickly now that one generation doesn't understand what the next generation is going through. And that's always been a complaint, right? You can go back to Socrates complaining about the young. But in these days, we've moved that evolution up to warp speed. And it's always been hard to raise children under any circumstances, but now especially, right? Because parents really don't know what the new technologies and the new environments that young people are going through. And so suddenly you've got this migration of rural people into an urban reality. They don't know how to navigate. Both parents very often are working now. Who's going to raise the children? What songs will they teach them? What values, what traditions, what, you know, and with both parents working, what are the influences on this next generation? And unfortunately, if you're at the bottom of an exclusionary society, in the ways that, you know, urban folk have always kind of looked down on rural folk, you know, city mouse, country mouse, you know, you've heard the fables forever. But suddenly these kids don't have a guide to teach them how to navigate this new reality. And they're often excluded from a lot of things. But who's offering them a ticket out? And here's where drugs come in. A lot of times the gangs and the narcos will offer them instant respect if you have a gun. You've got social mobility. You've got cash for the first time. You can date people. You can go out. And you can do all these things rather than work as your parents did in sweatshops. And so, you know, we have this inexhaustible reservoir, it seems, of people who would rather live as a king for a couple of years than as a pauper for 70 years. And attention must be paid to such people, right? So this is a boomerang that took a quarter century to come back and hit us. But Mexico, since President Calderon launched his disastrous drug war back in 2006, by, you know, taking the beginnings of a turf war and just beating the hornet's nest to the point where now there are hundreds of thousands of deaths as a result of that policy, over 200,000 at least. And they stopped counting a long time ago because it's too hard to disaggregate who was killed over common crime versus drug crime versus all these other things, etc.
We're listening to San Ho Tree, director of the Drug Policy Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, speaking on COVID, modernity, lifeways, and drug use. This is Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Now let's hear some more from San Ho Tree.
And so I think the government of China has much to look forward to in terms of problems coming down the line. That traditional lifeways have been severed, and we've evolved new ones at light speed. Without really giving thought to how they're going to fit in society and teach them how to be in this world. What is normal anymore, right? And this is what COVID and this lockdown has got me thinking about. What is normal and how do we find our place in society? How do we belong? And if 4 months in lockdown hasn't, you know, caused you to have some reflection about these things, I don't know what will. Maybe this talk. Let's see. We look around the world. And again, we see this world of concrete, steel, petroleum, silicon, in my artificial background. This is a Stanley Kubrick, is my interior designer from 2001 Space Odyssey. Anyway, this new world of concrete, steel, petroleum, silicon, and we think it's normal. We think it could only have been this way, right? This is how society was meant to evolve. But this wasn't inevitable. This was a result of choices that we made or failed to make as a society because we've privatized and deregulated all these sectors of our economy so that the market now decides for us what's going to take place next rather than policymakers. And the market doesn't really care about your children or grandchildren and their values and their the environment they're going to inherit. Put another way, the elders of the Iroquois Confederation had a saying. The Iroquois, we also stole in part our idea of a constitution in the Iroquois. Their elders were very wise, and they would ask this very simple question. How will the decisions we take today affect the seventh generation down the line? That's, I think, good long-term thinking, perhaps too long for a lot of people in the West these days. But I think it's a good way to approach the world. But whose job is it in our society to talk about these questions, right? We are, in fact, just making this up as we go along. We're building new lifeways without really much thought. Put another way, I'm talking to you via an iPad. I'm very much addicted to my iPhone and my Twitter way too much. But 20 years ago, did anyone talk to Steve Jobs. Did he ask anyone? Is this a good thing to unleash in the world? I get a lot of benefit from it, but I also see a lot of problems as a result of this that we never thought through initially, right? And I would even argue that Google and Facebook and their subsidiary corporations have done more harm to this planet than Goldman Sachs could ever dream of, simply because of what we're stuck with today in terms of Trump, in terms of Nazis, in terms of new realities that are being crafted with QAnon on the internet, right? People are going reality shopping on the internet in ways that their ancestors could never have dreamt of. 50 years ago, if you were a neo-Nazi or a John Birch Society member, maybe you got your monthly newspaper in the snail mail. But if you went down to your local bar and started, espousing your philosophy, you might get punched out fairly quickly, right? But today, you can go online and find hundreds of thousands of people who will tell you that you're normal, that this is the right way to think, that we've crafted new realities that have nothing to do with reality anymore. And so as a society, it becomes very difficult to have a rational discourse about public policy if we can't agree on what constitutes a baseline for reality. That's a big problem now. So we have not just Trumpism, but we have Bolsonaro, we have Putin, we have all these things that a lot of this was done through social media, right? It was a powerful tool that evolved partly from a lot of these technologies like the iPhone, the iPad, and others. We really didn't think these through, right? And I'm not saying we shouldn't have these things. I'm just saying that, you know, it'd be nice if we had some room to think about these things. And so there's an old African proverb that says, the last one to recognize the existence of water is the fish, because the fish is swimming through the water, right? And so we are the fish swimming through modernity, and we don't recognize that it's a fact that this is a reality that we created, either intentionally or unintentionally, and we have the power and capacity to change the future trajectory of our society. But only if we take that decision-making back from the free market and from others who are unelected or who care only about short-term objectives. If you look at how this intersects with our political system in solving complex problems, be it global warming, be it drug policy, we have politicians that think in terms of 2, 4, or 6 year election cycles, right? And once you're elected, your first concern is getting reelected. So you don't want to rock the boat too much. So we can't look to them for long-term thinking and long-term solutions. If you dare talk about, you know, planning even 5 years into the future, Fox News will call you a socialist. Our corporations think in terms of quarterly numbers. If you don't make your numbers, your stock will tank. You'll be taken over. You'll no longer be extant, and you'll be irrelevant, right? So whose job is it to look out for the interests of the seventh generation or even the next generation yet unborn? We don't have elders in our society the way our ancestors did. They revered elders for a good reason, because they've been on this planet for many, many decades, and they've seen the hubris and the impact of change on their local communities and societies. And so they can see trouble coming from around the corner, a mile away, that in many ways our young technocrats don't. And there's a lot of hubris involved. And the Greeks tried to teach us about that thousands of years ago, but the joke is on us, because you don't really get it until you get it. And by the time you get it, it's too late. Put it another way, there's an old saying that good judgment comes from experience, and experience comes from bad judgment. In other words, we learn from making mistakes, and it's important to, and it's not wrong to make a mistake, but it's important to learn from them, to acknowledge them, and then to evolve. And so the intersections of all these problems, and I think you're beginning to see the complexity of how drugs fit into this, right? People either turn to these substances through in search of solutions or insight. And drugs, particularly hallucinogens or entheogens, are very useful, can be very useful for offering tremendous insight, and in many ways could help heal our society. But also people use drugs to escape their reality, because they don't feel like they fit into this modernity, this world that they had no role in creating and don't know how to navigate. No one ever bothered teaching them, and just thrown into this. We're making this up as we go along. And we're doing a very bad job of it, I would argue. And so we do a lot of scapegoating now with drugs and say, aha, this is the problem.
We're listening to Sanho Tree, director of the Drug Policy Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, speaking on COVID, modernity, lifeways, and drug use. This is Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. There was a Q&A at the end. I had the good fortune to get in the first question, so here it is.
So here's one from Doug McVeigh. It was announced this week that the state of Oregon will be voting on a ballot measure this November to decriminalize simple possession of most illegal drugs. Do you support broad decriminalization generally, and do you think it's a measure that could have an impact on broader drug policy debate? Great question, Doug. I absolutely support it. The idea that we would incarcerate people for these problems really solves nothing. And there's also an individual liberty, a cognitive liberty aspect to this. I'm not an economic libertarian, but I am a civil libertarian. And in that sense, we give too much power to the state, that level of control, right? If you look at the founders of the nation and the Constitution, where in the Constitution does it give the right to the government to kick down your bedroom door, to arrest you and throw you into prison for something that you do to your body, absent harm to others? If there's no one else involved, if you grew your own drugs or whatever, and you're only doing it to yourself, where does the state get the right to intervene at such an intimate level and to destroy your life, basically, if you're doing that? If the state is allowed to do that, we get the drug war through our mother's milk, right? We get it from birth in our society. And so we assume these are normal state powers. They're not. Because if the state can intervene at such an intimate level into your own corpus, what is to stop the state from intervening in terms of sexual freedoms, reproductive rights? Where in the Constitution does it give the right to state for the state to decide what you do to your lungs, to your mouth, to your stomach, to your brain, to any of your orifices, absent harm to others? And should they be able to destroy your life as a result? If you don't have the sovereignty of your own corpus, you really don't have anything at all. Right? That's the most intimate and basic level.
You just heard Sanho Tree, director of the Drug Policy Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, speaking on COVID, modernity, lifeways, and drug use. His talk was part of an IPS webinar series entitled Progressive Politics and the Time of Pandemic. Other installments in that series and the full video of this presentation are available through the IPS website at ips-dc.org and on their YouTube channel. And that's it for this week. Thank you for joining us. You have been listening to Century of Lies. We're a production of the Drug Truth Network for the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network on the web at drugtruth.net. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of drugwarfacts.org. The executive producer of the Drug Truth Network is Dean Becker. Be sure to check out Dean's new video project, Becker's Buds. You can find links at drugtruth.net. The Drug Truth Network has a Facebook page. Please give it a like. Drug War Facts is on Facebook, too. Give its page a like and share it with friends. Remember, knowledge is power. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Doug McVeigh, and of course also at Drug Policy Facts. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy reform and the failed war on drugs. This is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long! For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the century of lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.